Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Imagine walking into a room where five investors are waiting, the cameras are rolling, and you just have a few minutes to convince them that your idea is worth backing. That's the pressure entrepreneurs face when they step onto the stage of the hit TV show Shark Tank. And our guest today experienced exactly that. He's Ari Siegel, an entrepreneur originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and now based in Chicago. He's also the founder of History by Mail, a company that brings history to life through primary documents and storytelling. What began as a side project eventually caught national attention when Ari stepped into the Shark Tank to pitch his business to the investors. A longtime Toastmaster, Ari credits the organization with helping him develop communication skills that prepared him for one of the most high-pressure speaking moments imaginable, pitching his idea on national television in front of millions of viewers. Ari shares that experience in the article, Taking My Speaking Skills to TV, How Toastmasters Prepared Me for Shark Tank, appears in the March 2026 issue of the Toastmaster magazine, where he talks about keeping cool in the tank when the pressure was on. Ari Siegel, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Ari, congratulations. And the good news is you're not in the Shark Tank right now, so you can just relax.
Thank you.
So, Ari, to kick us off, take us back to that moment. Paint the picture for us. You walk into the room, the sharks are there. As I mentioned earlier, the cameras are rolling. What's going through your mind?
Well, I had prepared for thousands of hours. I was preparing through for the better part of a year to be on the show. And when that moment happened, I was so well prepared that I actually was excited. I wasn't nervous. Oftentimes when I'm giving a speech, I am nervous, but I had watched every episode of Shark Tank up until that point and taken extensive notes and practiced questions on note cards wherever I was for nearly a year. And I even created life-size cutouts of each shark so that I could practice speaking to them with any type of emotion they could come at you. Sometimes they're looking frustrated or they might say something disparaging about your idea, and you have to keep a smile on your face and keep cool and your composure and keep entertaining.
You're prepared for every contingency. Was there ever a thought about, oh, I'm going to be speaking in front of millions of people?
Yes, there was. I actually hired a Broadway producer to help me get through all the little elements that happen on the show, because you have to prepare not just your speaking and your props and the lighting and what you're going to wear and wardrobe and all that. And they give some advice that you're really only speaking to five people. You're not speaking to millions. And that helped me refocus and calm my nerves.
Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with History by Mail, we touched upon it in the intro. Can you give us a little idea as to what the business is about and how did you first come up with the idea?
So History by Mail is a subscription service to replicas of historical documents from American history. For example, the check that was used to purchase Alaska from Russia. So what we do is we take that primary source document and we replicate it as close to the original as possible, and we mail them with a context story to subscribers all over the world. And the idea came to me, I was a U.S. Senate intern and I gave tours of the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. One day I was at the Library of Congress and they had recently discovered a letter that was sitting in a box in a warehouse from President Abraham Lincoln. And as I describe on the show, seeing the original handwriting of President Lincoln gave me the chills and instantly transported me to the Civil War era. The thought that thousands of documents that belong to the American people are just sitting in boxes and warehouses somewhere, that didn't seem right. So I started replicating them for family and friends, not thinking that it would turn into a national business. And people loved it and kept asking for more. And it just grew organically from there.
It's funny because you think these days with everything going digital that something by mail just wouldn't be as appealing.
Yes, that very perceptive. We are an analog company in a digital world, and especially in the AI world. The more things go digital, there's a part of many people that wants that physical, tangible connection to something. And history is often very intangible. It's often learned through secondary sources. You watch a movie, listen to a podcast, you could read a book, for example. But unless you're actually traveling to a historic site or speaking to someone who has survived something in history, you're very often one step removed from history. So by us putting physical, tangible pieces in people's hands, it makes it more real. And I think the more that people are in the digital world, there's a part of us that also craves the physical.
Wow. It's funny that we're talking about this now, because maybe about a week or two ago, I can't remember if I was reading an article or where I saw something on the news where the Gen Zs, I guess you call them the Gen Zs,
yeah,
and the Gen As are going back. They're going analog. In fact, I believe Barnes & Noble is talking about bringing back the pocket paperback so that you can put them in your pocket.
Wow.
Vinyl has seen such a huge comeback. So
yes.
Yeah, what you're saying makes absolute sense.
Just in mail, I get so much email that when I can go to my mailbox and physically pick up mail, even if it's junk mail, I get excited.
Well, that's great to know. And of course, that's good for your business. So how did Shark Tank get on your radar? Did you apply? Did they find out about you? How did that all come about?
I don't 100% know. They reached out to me. A casting director emailed our customer service email, and my head of customer service forwarded the email and said, hey, do you want to be on Shark Tank? And at first, I didn't think it was real. We got a lot of spam. I just didn't think it was real. And then they were persistent, and I thought, well, wouldn't hurt for me to take a phone call. And it turned out to be real. And it turns out they rarely reach out to entrepreneurs. They either take casting calls or people apply on their website. Shark Tank gets nearly 40,000 applications per year, and they end up taping only about 200 per year and airing about half of those. And so we were incredibly lucky, blessed to be able to have them reach out. And I asked the casting director, how did you find me? And they said they didn't know. So it's still a little bit of a mystery.
Maybe one day you'll find out, or you'll discover. But that's amazing. My guess is someone saw this in passing, or perhaps they became aware of your business and said, "We need this guy."
Yes, and they did say that it is unusual. They have never had something like it on their 16 prior seasons. Now they're on their 17th season. And so they're always looking for unique new ideas. And they thought it would make good TV too.
No, absolutely. Anything that makes good TV is great these days, because with all the special effects and AI, when you've got something real, something tangible, it's great. Now, you mentioned previously about how you spent hundreds of hours preparing. You talked about the cutouts. You talked about everything else. For the benefit of Toastmasters and speakers, how is pitching in that environment different from delivering a speech or a presentation?
Well, if I can reframe the question, I actually think it's extremely similar to Toastmasters. There are two parts of every Shark Tank pitch. There's the initial 90 seconds where you're pitching your idea, and that's the prepared speech. And then the rest of the episode is question and answer, and that's table topics. Shark Tank, the format is extremely similar to your average Toastmasters meeting.
Oh, that's an interesting observation. I'm thinking back when I watched the show as to how the investors just love to grill you, especially Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary. I was just curious, Ari, what was the toughest question that one of the sharks asked you?
That's a good question. For me, it wasn't so much the questions, it was the dynamic of the room. There are a lot of people speaking at once, and you have to politely answer everybody in turn, and they might be interrupting each other and asking rapid-fire questions. In table topics, there's one person typically asking a question, and then you go up and answer. Imagine four or five people talking over each other, asking questions at the same time, and you have to remember them all and make sure everybody feels good. You know, if someone feels slighted, then you might lose them just with that. So that was a difficult part for me. Another difficult part was when a shark is out and they say, this isn't for me for such and such reason. And that's a letdown because you don't have that many other chances. And so just to keep my countenance up and keep my mood positive is something I practiced a lot.
Wow. Yeah, no, I certainly recall watching the show. When someone says, I'm out, you can see the air out of the balloon just deflates, and you see how the camera always pans back to the person who's pitching, and you can kind of see the face just dropped.
And they prepared us for that. They just said, you have to keep going and just stay positive.
Yeah. You said you kept positive, but was there actually a moment during the pitch where you thought, okay, this is going either really well or really bad?
Well, right after I made the 90-second pitch, I had to do a quick wardrobe change, and they all said, oh, that was an amazing pitch. I knew things were going well at that point. But when I went into the tank, I really wanted Mark Cuban, and it was actually his last week on the show. He's not on the show anymore. And I had worked for about 6 months to get the document that I gave him the use rights to show that on TV. The document that I gave him was the 13 original rules of basketball. It's the document that created the sport of basketball. And it is owned by the University of Kansas, which I license. We got them to agree to allow to have it on the show. Well, Mark Cuban was former owner of the Dallas Mavericks and a huge basketball fan. So I thought this would be perfect. So I give him the document, and he says, someone sends this to me just about once a month. And my heart just dropped. I thought this was going to be just the perfect match and he would just love it. And he's saying, I see this all the time. I don't care. And so that was just this moment that I had to just keep moving on and keep staying positive.
It's so easy for them to make an off-the-cuff remark, not realizing what kind of impact it makes on people.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious how you obviously handled these questions, the rapid-fire questions, and I certainly understand how you get five people throwing things at you and you happen to maybe miss one. They get annoyed. They say, you know what? You're ignoring me. I'm out. Mm-hmm. I've seen that so many times happen. Tell me how your learning or practicing or engaging in table topics in Toastmasters helped you handle those. And is there a particular example when something in particular kicked in?
Well, I talked a lot about mood. So I think that's positive. Also remembering that communication is not just your words. It's also your body language and your tone. And that's something that is completely in your control and you can practice ahead of time, even when you don't know the question that's going to come at you. So that was very helpful from Table Topics as well. Also, in our club, a lot of times Table Topics had a general theme that was announced beforehand, whether it was in the email prior to the meeting or even at the beginning of the meeting. And that does give you a little bit of time to prepare, even if it's mentally, even if you don't know 100% the exact questions. You can start to think about some talking points that you might leverage. Another tool that was very helpful in preparing is an exercise, a public speaking exercise called headlines, which is anytime someone asks you a question, you quickly create a soundbite and start your answer with that. And that's a specific skill you can practice. And those soundbites makes excellent television as well.
That's great. I really noticed that you use the body language, your posture, your eye contact. Out of curiosity, when you were doing your prep, were you practicing those?
Oh yeah, completely. In my preparation for Shark Tank, I, as I mentioned, practiced hundreds of hours. Some of those were in front of a mirror, looking at my own eye contact. I recorded myself answering things and watched the videos. That's very helpful. I practiced in front of family and friends and had their feedback as well. And I even created a little video, which was spliced images of each of the sharks in various moods. So I could react positive, whether they were smiling or frowning or looking disinterested or even looking at their cell phone, which is something that happens, but they cut out.
Oh, wow. OMG. I'm asking this question because I recall a number of years ago, I believe it was Craig Valentine, a world champion public speaker. He visited our district 1 year, and I remember, I think it was him or maybe it was Jim Key. I apologize to you guys. I remember them replaying their world champion speech and how they practiced and how they positioned themselves and how in their notes when they created the speech or when they were working through their speech, they specifically mentioned those types of things. And it's something that you never think of because often when typically we're just watching TV or if we're watching Shark Tank, we're just listening for the pitch. We're not looking for all those nuances. And it was obvious that you put those in. In addition, of course, you had the props, you had the storytelling. And then, of course, I forgot to mention earlier is that the variation in your voice in the pitch. And I'm sure those were all intentional. And as I was watching that open, I thought, he's a Toastmaster, no doubt.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Greg. I am a Toastmaster. And I think that identity is the biggest skill of Toastmasters. It takes people who want to improve their public speaking. And over time, they do. And you never know when you're going to answer that call. I didn't join Toastmasters to go on national TV. I joined it to be able to communicate better. And when this opportunity came around, I was excited and confident and knew that I could succeed. And I don't know that I would have been able to do that had I not thought of myself as someone who had those skills, and that is directly related to Toastmasters.
Yeah, that's great. So obviously you were very confident going in. Was there actually an intimidating moment or was it pretty cool?
The whole process is intimidating. They, as I mentioned, you're whittling down roughly 40,000 people to about 100. And it gets more competitive from there because those are just 100 people or entrepreneurs that air. But then roughly 60, 70% of those are getting deals. And then only a certain percentage of those deals actually close in reality. And you sign a contract with a shark. And then an even smaller percentage of those get a update or look back segment in a subsequent season.
Oh, interesting. So we're talking about offers. So you received the offer. Maybe just walk us through a little bit. What was that moment like?
Well, I received two offers, one from Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary, and one from Barbara Corcoran and Daniel Lebetsky coming in together. Mm-hmm. And I had to make a decision. It was the same offer, same amount of equity and same amount of money. But in the end, I decided two sharks were better than one. And so I had the opportunity to turn down Mr. Wonderful and accept Barbara and Daniel's offer. In the end, after about 6 months of due diligence, it was Daniel Lebetsky that actually closed the deal. And then about 4 months later, we were approached to join the show yet again for season 17 for an update segment.
That's awesome. I'm just curious, the moment that you got the offer, was there like a big lump in your throat?
I had to quickly think, what do I want to do here? And just confidently go for it. You know, I think it often takes people when they get multiple offers, they're on the show and you can see you don't really know who's the best one. But then when you leave the tank, you walk down the hallway and there's this reaction shot. And then they do a quick little post episode interview where they ask you, how do you feel? Are you excited about the future? And we speak about that.
What was the most surprising thing about the entire experience?
Just being there. I was just a guy living my life. And then I get my moment in Hollywood and Sony Studios in Los Angeles and right next to movie stars that are having their set just, you know, a few feet over in the next room. That's just an incredible experience. And then the next day, I go back to just being a regular guy working at my job.
Or obviously, you're more than a regular guy. The business has been extremely, extremely successful. What happened after the episode aired? And maybe this is a good opportunity to tell us sort of how things went, what changed. And you also mentioned a follow-up episode.
Yes. Well, there's the Shark Tank effect. You go from being a brand that doesn't have national exposure and you have to pay for all your advertising. And then suddenly we're on national television in front of millions of viewers. So the minute the episode aired, our traffic exploded and we saw the best day we had ever had in our company history, including during holiday sales seasons. We had the best week we ever had, best month we ever had. And our company has roughly doubled since we originally aired last April. We're coming up on a year here. And so that's been incredible. Our mission is to enable everybody to have a tangible connection to history. And our mission was forwarded so much more by getting this incredible exposure. Okay, as for the update, I was approached 4 months after the episode aired to come back onto the show to talk about our increase in business. Well, 4 months isn't very long. And although we had increased a lot, typically update segments take several years for entrepreneurs to come back onto the show. And so I was searching for a better angle, a better TV story than just we have more business. Our shark, Daniel Lebetsky, is good friends with David Copperfield, the famous magician.
No way.
And I knew that David Copperfield has the largest private collection of magic history in the world because I had written a piece on Harry Houdini, and that piece was in David Copperfield's private museum in Las Vegas. So I asked Daniel whether he would ask David if we could do a partnership together and that could be the hook for the episode. And he agreed. And so the episode is filmed at David's private museum of magic in Las Vegas. And as a child, David Copperfield saw a photograph of Harry Houdini conducting a disappearing elephant illusion in 1918 at the New York Hippodrome, which is the largest venue in the world at the time. And as a child, David was inspired by that photograph because it changed magic from just card and rope tricks to large-scale illusions. That sparked in him this sense of wonder. And there's a letter that Harry Houdini wrote to Harry Keller, who was the world's most famous magician in the generation prior to Harry Houdini. He's the magician that The Wizard of Oz is modeled after. That letter is owned by David Copperfield, and he allowed me to replicate that along with the image, the photograph that inspired him as a child. And David Copperfield also wrote a letter to History by Mail subscribers talking about that whole journey. And now what he's going to do next as his next grand scale illusion is to make the moon disappear. He's working with NASA and scientists on three continents. And so from that original piece of history that sparked his imagination, it sparked his whole career, including making the moon disappear. So it just shows the impact of history and how that isn't just in the past. It can inspire people's entire careers and change the course of their future.
Now that's magical. Pardon the pun.
Yes, definitely.
Wow. Absolutely incredible. I've got to see this. Wow. Ari, if you wanted to offer one piece of advice for an entrepreneur who's thinking of applying or pitching to the Shark Tank, what do you think that would be and why?
Hone your storytelling skills. I think that's an incredible piece of this. Every entrepreneur has a story to tell, not just why they have a product or service and what need it serves, but how they came to be. And if you can tell that in a compelling way, you can attract people, whether that's investors or that's customers.
Yeah, that's certainly sage advice. And folks, if you're now thinking of trying to be on the Shark Tank or you're interested in History by Mail, I encourage you to share this episode with your friends and family and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And of course, remember to check out Ari's article, Taking My Speaking Skills to TV, How Toastmasters Prepared Me for Shark Tank, which appears in the March 2026 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. And before we leave, Ari, if someone is interested in reaching out to you to find out more about History by Mail or perhaps to get some Shark Tank advice, what's the best way for them to reach you?
You can visit historybymail.com, and there's a contact us page. That's the best way to reach me. And check out our incredible subscriptions at historybymail.com.
Ari Siegel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, and all the best in your future endeavors.
Thank you.